Good evening and welcome. This is the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, May 29th, 2025. My name is Greg Riddell for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today's intro is by Kurt Schillinger, Managing Editor. Tamara Kosmina was an architect and ethnographer in Ukraine. Her studies on traditional folk architecture captured how societies articulate their values through both constructions and constructed texts. Now, 9 years after her passing, a presentation of her work on show at the Venice Biennale captures something new, the dignity of her invaded country. The exhibition takes something as humble yet essential as a roof, a symbol of shelter, and transforms it into a lens through which we see human resilience during wartime. An artificial intelligence-generated avatar of Ms. Kosmina says, as Dominique Sogel writes in her story today, "The concept of rebuilding and resistance go hand in hand." We'll start with some news briefs. A court blocked President Donald Trump's sweeping tariffs. The ruling came after several lawsuits argued President Trump exceeded his authority, leaving trade policy dependent on his whims. Mr. Trump says he has the power to act because the country's trade deficits amount to a national emergency. The U.S. Court of International Trade found the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act does not authorize the use of tariffs. Elon Musk is leaving the Trump administration. After spearheading efforts to reduce and overhaul the federal bureaucracy, the billionaire entrepreneur posted Wednesday about his decision on X, his social media website. Mr. Musk's departure comes one day after he criticized the centerpiece of Mr. Trump's legislative agenda, saying he was disappointed by what the president calls his big, beautiful bill. Germany moved to back Ukraine. Amid global uncertainty, Europe was eager for the country to take on leadership after February's election. New Chancellor Friedrich Merz seems determined to deliver emphatically. His top priority, shoring up support for Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Berlin Wednesday, and Germany promised Ukraine a 5 billion euro package of aid and the joint production of weapons systems, including long-range missiles. The U.S. will revoke the visas of some Chinese students. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the move includes those with connections to the Chinese Communist Party or studying in critical fields. The announcement adds to the uncertainty for America's international students who have faced intensifying scrutiny from the Trump administration. A sexual abuse trial raised questions in France. Surgeon Joël Lesquarnec was sentenced to 20 years in prison Wednesday for raping and abusing 299 patients, most of them minors, between 1989 and 2014. The case represents the largest of its kind in France's history. It comes less than a year after Dominique Pellicot was sentenced to 20 years in prison for drugging and sexually abusing his wife for a decade, and luring dozens of others to do the same. Both cases have raised questions about the 20-year maximum period for sexual abuse crimes, which opponents call too lenient. The EU lifted economic sanctions on Syria. The European Union seeks to support the country's recovery after the toppling of former President Bashar al-Assad. It said it will keep sanctions related to Mr. Assad's government, while also introducing new ones against those connected to a wave of violence in March. Harvard agrees to relinquish early photos of enslaved people. The images will be transferred to a South Carolina museum devoted to African American history. The settlement ends a 15-year legal battle to release the 19th century daguerreotypes made by an early photographic method. Now for our stories. As food trickles into Gaza, UN calls U.S.-Israeli plan vastly insufficient. Israel has begun easing its blockade on humanitarian aid to Gaza. On Monday, trucks began rolling into the besieged Palestinian enclave with essential supplies. On Tuesday, Israel began distributing food through a controversial U.S.-backed mechanism. But UN officials say these steps are vastly insufficient and a distraction from what is actually needed. International aid organizations remain sidelined, and Gaza residents say their social fabric is unraveling as people scrounge to feed their families. By Ghada Abdul Fattah and Taylor Luck, reporting from Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip, and Amman, Jordan. Even amid Israel's intensified military operations in Gaza and the ever-evolving displacement of the enclave's Palestinian residents, another Israel-Hamas war flashpoint has come to the fore this week: the entry and distribution of life-saving aid. On Tuesday, Israel began distributing food through a controversial U.S.-backed mechanism it is implementing unilaterally in southern Gaza, cutting out international aid organizations that have been working on the ground in the Strip for years. The United Nations has been largely sidelined in Gaza, watching as an observer with its Gaza staff on standby and its warehouses on the other side of the border in Egypt full of aid, medicine, and fuel that Israel has declined to approve. The Israel-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF, said Wednesday it has so far distributed about 14,550 food boxes, totaling 462,000 meals, in new Israeli distribution hubs patrolled by U.S. security contractors. As of Monday, since Israel eased an 11-week siege blocking aid last week, 294 trucks have trickled into Gaza, a fraction of the 500 trucks that experts say are needed daily. Yet many Gaza residents say they are unable to reach to GHF centers and UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, spokesperson Jens Lerke criticized the Israeli program Tuesday as vastly insufficient and a distraction from what is actually needed. He called for a reopening of all the crossings into Gaza, a secure environment within Gaza, and faster facilitation of permissions and final approvals of all the emergency supplies that we have just outside the border. Israel says this new distribution mechanism prevents the militant group Hamas from receiving and monopolizing aid. Initial setbacks. But in its first days, the program has received setbacks. The GHF's director resigned Sunday, shortly before it began operations, saying it was unable to fulfill the principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence. And on the GHF's first day in action, Tuesday, pandemonium erupted at one overcrowded distribution center. Thousands of Palestinians in Gaza breached a fence and forced the U.S. contractors to temporarily withdraw. The foundation said it resumed work later in the day and operated without incident Wednesday. Reportedly, Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians walked through Israeli military lines and checkpoints inside Gaza to reach the distribution centers. We have the supplies, plan, will, and networks to deliver massive amounts of life-saving aid to civilians in Gaza, OCHA Chief Tom Fletcher said in a statement late Tuesday. Enough. Let us work. No more time to lose. The needs are urgent. 1 in 5 Palestinians in Gaza faces starvation, according to the UN-backed Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Platform. As part of its plans for a renewed large-scale invasion of Gaza, the Israeli army established 4 distribution centers, all located in the Rafah area in the southern part of the Strip, where only a few hundred thousand of Gaza's 2 million residents reside. Yet many people are unable to reach the centers on foot, let alone carry 45-pound packages containing a week's worth of supplies. It creates a double crisis for Palestinians in Gaza. Hope and answers are just as scarce as food. Like many Gaza residents, Mona Al-Ghula, who is 7 months pregnant, worries about the Israeli distribution plan. I don't want to go to Rafah. I can't. It's too far. And there is no transport. Do I go and die on the way? Ms. Al-Ghula says from her makeshift tent in a displacement camp in Deir al-Balah. In a nearby tent, Kitam Salameh agrees. They want to give us flour, but how can I carry it? She asks. I can't walk to the distribution point. I cry from the pain. She pauses and gestures towards her legs. It's not about the bread, says Ms. Salameh. It's about the insult. To stand in line while snipers watch you, to beg for flour with a gun pointed at you or your child. It is a common fear rooted in family tragedy. In February, Ms. Al-Ghula's husband was killed by an Israeli sniper while receiving aid for the family. Redistributing limited aid. With limited aid getting in, Gaza volunteers who have been working with UN agencies and their partners to distribute aid to their communities are doing what they can to make meager food stretch. Khaled Othman, a community leader and volunteer, walks among families in a displaced camp with a half-filled bag of bread in his hand, rare food received from the World Food Program using Israel-provided aid. He and others from the camp council are redistributing the little food they received. We took 1 or 2 loaves from each bag, he explains, to give something, anything, to those who got nothing. What else could we do? Mr. Othman, like other community leaders, is waiting for when and if international aid organizations and the UN return to Gaza. Until then, there are no real solutions, he says. Just effort. Sometimes it's food, sometimes clothes, sometimes just keeping people from losing hope. Both Palestinians in Gaza and international aid organizations say Gaza residents need far more than the food packages the Israeli plan is providing, such as shelter, clean water, sanitation, and hygiene supplies. Ms. Al-Ghula and her 3 children live with a friend, who is a mother of 6, and her sister-in-law. Their tent, like many, is made of stitched plastic and warped wood, and offers little protection from the winter cold or the heat of Gaza's summer. I wanted food, but I also wanted a new tent. I pray for anyone who could provide me with a tent, she says. Ms. Al-Ghula constantly worries about how she will take care of her 4th baby now that diapers and baby formula have disappeared from the market. Bartering for anything edible. With store shelves long emptied and aid scarcely trickling in, some Gaza residents have turned to social media as a last resort, bartering over whatever they have left. In one Facebook post, a resident offered a carton of instant coffee in exchange for a small bag of flour. In another, a woman posted a photo of a pack of laundry detergent, pleading to trade it for anything edible. As hunger tightens its grip, Gaza's fragile social fabric is beginning to unravel. Petty theft and black market dealings are on the rise, and tensions simmer in overcrowded shelters. In recent weeks, sporadic protests have broken out, not only against the relentless war, but also against Hamas authorities and negotiators as frustration mounts over the scarcity of food and the absence of a clear path forward. At dawn, Ms. Salame sits hunched outside her tattered tent, her hands working dough made from mashed pasta, boiled, beaten, and kneaded into a poor imitation of bread. She paid $20 for the bag of pasta, one of the few items available for sale. Her 16-year-old daughter tends to a small fire. Rats scurry along the edges of their nylon walls. This is breakfast. They're just killing us slowly now, Ms. Salome says, glancing at her daughter. There was a time, she remembers, when she had canned beans, pasta, even a few precious sachets of lentils. Now, she says, aid distribution is out of reach. I had been borrowing flour for some days, says Ms. Salome. She pauses, but now I have nothing. Next story. Homes destroyed. River blocked. A Swiss village is buried by glacier debris. An avalanche of mud, ice, and rock forced residents of a picturesque Swiss village to evacuate before it buried around 90% of it. The debris from a collapsed glacier also blocked a nearby river, raising concerns of flooding. By Dave Graham, Weiler, Switzerland. Residents struggled on Thursday to absorb the scale of devastation caused by a huge slab of glacier that buried most of their picturesque Swiss village, in what scientists suspect is a dramatic example of climate change's impact on the Alps. A deluge of millions of cubic meters of ice, mud, and rock crashed down a mountain on Wednesday, engulfing the village of Blatten, and the few houses that remained were later flooded. Its 300 residents had already been evacuated earlier in May after part of the mountain behind the Birch Glacier began to crumble. Rescue teams with search dogs and thermal drone scans have continued looking for a missing 64-year-old man, but have found nothing. Local authorities suspended the search on Thursday afternoon, saying the debris mounds were too unstable for now, and warned of further rock falls. With the Swiss Army closely monitoring the situation, flooding worsened during the day as vast mounds of debris, almost 2 kilometers across, clogged the path of the River Lanza, causing a huge lake to form amid the wreckage and raising fears that the morass could dislodge. Water levels have been rising by 80 centimeters an hour from the blocked river and melting glacier ice. Stefan Ganzer, head of the security division for the Valais Canton, told reporters. Swiss President Karin Keller-Sutter is returning early from high-level talks in Ireland and will visit the site on Friday, her office said. I don't want to talk just now. I lost everything yesterday. I hope you understand, said one middle-aged woman from Blatten, declining to give her name as she sat alone, disconsolately, in front of a church in the neighboring village of Weiler. Nearby, the road ran along the valley before ending abruptly at the mass of mud and debris now blanketing her own village. A thin cloud of dust hung in the air over the Kleines Nesthorn Mountain where the rock slide occurred while a helicopter buzzed overhead. Werner Bellwald, a cultural studies expert, lost the wooden family house built in 1654, where he lived, in Ried, a hamlet next to Blatten, also wiped out by the deluge. "You can't tell that there was ever a settlement there," he told Reuters. "Things happened there that no one here thought were possible." Profound shock. The worst scenario would be that a wave of debris bursts the nearby Ferden Dam, Valet Canton official Ganser said. He added that the chances of this further mudslide were currently unlikely, noting that the dam had been emptied as a precaution so it could act as a buffer zone. Local authorities said that the buildings in Blatten, which had emerged intact from the landslide, are now flooded and that some residents of nearby villages have been evacuated. The army said around 50 personnel, as well as water pumps, diggers, and other heavy equipment, were on standby to provide relief when it was safe. Authorities were airlifting livestock out of the area, said Jonas Jeitzener, a local official in Weiler, as a few sheep scrambled out of a container lowered from a helicopter. Asked about how he felt about the future, he said, gazing towards the plain of mud, "Right now, the shock is so profound that one can't think about it yet." The catastrophe has revived concern about the impact of rising temperatures on alpine permafrost, where thawing has loosened some rock structures, creating new mountain hazards. For years, the Birch Glacier has been creeping down the mountainside, pressured by shifting debris near the summit. Matthias Huss, head of glacier monitoring in Switzerland, pointed to the likely influence of climate change in loosening the rock mass among the permafrost, which triggered the collapse. "Unexpected things happen at places that we have not seen for hundreds of years, most probably due to climate change," he told Reuters. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of reading from over 200 publications. Next story. U.S.-Iran nuclear talks benefit from Trump's desire for a peace deal. As complex and daunting a problem as Iran's steadily advancing nuclear program may be, for now, it still may offer President Donald Trump the best option for burnishing his self-image as a deal-maker and peacemaker. By Howard LaFranchi. Donald Trump has long pledged that in his second term he would be the peace president, resolving quickly the wars and international security crises threatening world peace. But with a ceasefire in Ukraine looking as far off as ever, and Israel intensifying its war in Gaza, Mr. Trump appears to be shifting his attention to a third arena for securing his reputation, Iran, and its steadily advancing nuclear program. Americans, and indeed the world, could expect something good in a matter of days on diplomatic efforts to curtail Iran's nuclear program and bar it from ever attaining a nuclear weapon, the president said Sunday. No one, either at the White House or among analysts focused on Iran, suggests that good news could be an actual deal resolving the nuclear issue, but some say it could be something like an interim agreement laying out the parameters for a deal, or perhaps an Iranian agreement to temporarily modify its uranium enrichment activities, slowing its path to the fuel required for a bomb. Whatever the good news, it would allow the president to show progress in resolving, with no bombs dropped, as he says he prefers, a key threat to global peace and stability. Moreover, as complex and daunting a problem as Iran's nuclear program may be, it would fortify Mr. Trump's drooping self-image as someone who can take what he calls bad deals and make them good deals. The Iran negotiations are the best opportunity for Trump to resolve an international crisis, says Kelsey Davenport, director for nonproliferation policy at the Arms Control Association in Washington. Factors favoring a deal. Noting that the political will to reach a deal exists on both sides and that negotiations are ongoing, Ms. Davenport adds, nothing is assured, but compared to Gaza and Ukraine, Iran holds the promise of an international challenge where Trump can make a deal and avert a crisis. By reaching a deal with Iran on its nuclear program, Mr. Trump would be making good on a commitment to take what he calls the bad deal that President Barack Obama reached with Iran in 2015 and replacing it with a better one. In his first term, Mr. Trump pulled the United States out of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action negotiated with Iran, shifting to a maximum pressure campaign. That policy failed to slow Iran's nuclear progress, and he never reached a new deal. Still, a number of factors favor reaching a deal under Trump 2.0, not the least of which is Iran's weaker economic and regional standing today, analysts say. Others say international factors appear to be feeding Iran's openness to moving forward in an attempt to head off looming worse alternatives. At the top of that list is Israel and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's clear and public preference for military action now to take out Iran's nuclear facilities. Mr. Netanyahu is said to be worried that President Trump's desire for the acclaim that would come with the deal will ultimately leave Iran with an enrichment program and the capability of building a bomb. On Wednesday, Mr. Trump confirmed reports that he had warned Mr. Netanyahu in a weekend phone call against striking Iran. I just said we're having very good discussions with the Iranians, and I don't think it's appropriate right now, the president said. The Israeli leader, joined by some of Mr. Trump's top national security advisors and hawkish Republican senators, says a full cessation of Iran's enrichment activities and complete dismantling of its nuclear program is the only acceptable outcome. Iran, on the other hand, says that as a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, it has a right to a peaceful nuclear program that includes uranium enrichment for powering energy production. But also likely to be figuring in Iran's calculations are the influence of the White House faction favoring military action. When might the hawks carry the day with a mercurial president and prospects for a European Union-led return to tough economic sanctions on Iran over its nuclear advancements? Tougher negotiating tactic? Indeed, some analysts say that instead of encouraging Iran with public hints of diplomatic progress, Mr. Trump should be underscoring the implications for Tehran if he decides the Iranians are stringing him along. I'd be wary of how good is the good news the president is talking about, because the reality is that the two sides are still miles apart, says Benam Ben Taleblu, a senior fellow focusing on Iranian security and political issues at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington. If you're Iran, you want to initiate blips of optimism that allow the regime to continue limping along, he says. But None of it means they're seriously adjusting their position on their nuclear program. They're still just seeking to fit square pegs into round holes. In that scenario, Mr. Trump's best option may be to push away from the table and call Iran's bluff, he says. The president's best chance of getting a deal is to play up the regime's fears about the consequences of not seriously negotiating now. Mr. Ben Taleblu's first recommendation would be for the Trump administration to move away from talks with Iran and coordinate with the EU on steps toward the snapback to the steep economic sanctions the Iranians most fear. Those sanctions are set to return in October, but European officials have said that they are considering moving up the timing by months. The Arms Control Association's Ms. Davenport says she also sees risks in a hasty declaration of good news that could ultimately make a diplomatic resolution of Iran's nuclear challenge less likely. Noting the president's short attention span, she says she worries Mr. Trump could declare victory early over some interim steps and lose the momentum to move towards a comprehensive deal. But that might only assure that the diplomatic path is eventually closed off, she says, and the hawks pressing for military intervention get their way. If Trump allows Netanyahu and others in the administration to push to no enrichment and full dismantlement of the nuclear program, Iran is going to walk away, she says, and there aren't many alternatives as to where that leads. Next story. War in Gaza asks Israelis what kind of state they want. Against the background of war in Gaza, Israelis face questions about their state's identity and future. By Ned Temko, London. A diplomatic tsunami is how one Israeli newspaper has dubbed intensifying criticism from Israel's Western allies of its latest military attacks and the dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza. But this international anger, contrasting sharply with the sympathy that most of the world offered Israel after Hamas murdered and abducted hundreds of civilians on October 7, 2023, may be diverting attention from an even greater impact of the war in Gaza. It has revived long-simmering questions for Israelis about their country's bedrock principles, its future direction, and its very identity, questions that go to the soul of the state, founded just a few years after Adolf Hitler's mass murder of the Jews of Europe. Answering these questions has been made both more urgent and more difficult by the attack of October 7th. More urgent because Hamas's murderous assault shredded a founding promise of the Israeli state to create a haven where, after centuries of diaspora prejudice culminating in the Holocaust, Jews could finally feel safe. But more difficult, too, because the trauma of October 7th for Israelis of all stripes, Orthodox and secular, left of center and right wing, West Bank settlers and Tel Aviv tech entrepreneurs, still runs deep. Nowhere has that been more evident until now than in most Israelis' inability to comprehend the scale of destruction in Gaza or to connect on a human level with the agony of its Palestinian civilian victims. That, at least, could be starting to change. In recent days, street protesters urging Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to prioritize the release of Israeli hostages from Gaza have begun holding up photos of Palestinian children alongside the images of captive Israelis. Opinion polls have suggested some erosion of long, solid support for Israel's blockade on food and humanitarian supplies to Gaza. Former members of Israel's political and security establishment have also moved beyond criticism of the government's conduct of the war to denounce its impact on Palestinian civilians. They have not minced their words either, using terms such as war crimes and ethnic cleansing. However the war ends, the legacy of October 7th will impel Israelis to reopen a divisive debate about their country's identity and future direction. Some of the questions date back to the foundation of the state in May 1948. What is Israel's core identity? A Jewish state by a mix of language, religion, tradition, and demographics? Should it explicitly define non-Jewish citizens as playing a lesser role in the national narrative? What place should the Orthodox and religious nationalist community occupy? Dominant or part of a broader tapestry, including the majority of Israeli Jews who are secular or less observant? What about the key issue raised by October 7th, security? What role does military power play? Can arms alone ensure long-term security? And perhaps the most challenging question of all, should, can peace be sought with the Palestinians? The early decades of the Israeli state were shaped by labor Zionist luminaries such as Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion, who were mostly East European secular socialist idealists. The 1948 Declaration of Independence declared that Israel will uphold the full social and political equality of all its citizens without distinction of race, creed, or sex, and will guarantee full freedom of conscience, worship, education, and culture. The founding doctrine of Israel's military included a commitment to Tohar Hanashek, or purity of arms, enjoining soldiers to use minimum necessary force and do all they could do to avoid harming civilians. But a succession of Mideast wars administered shocks to the political compass, as October 7th seems likely to do. In the 1967 Six-Day War, Israel gained control of the West Bank of the Jordan River and Gaza, then home to around 1.5 million Palestinians. Even before 1948, a more right-wing stream of Zionism had embraced the dream of a Jewish state in all of biblical Palestine. Now, Greater Israel became a live political issue. Ben-Gurion's heirs, still in charge, assumed that some sort of land for peace deal would eventually be possible. Then came a very different war, with a surprise attack by Egypt and Syria in October 1973. Israel prevailed, but not before suffering setbacks and heavy losses that jolted Israelis' faith in their military's preparedness as dramatically as the Hamas attack did half a century later. The after effects were profound. Labor Zionism was voted out a few years later in favor of the right-wing Likud party under Menachem Begin. He launched a widespread effort to plant Jewish settlements in the West Bank, with the explicit aim of making it impossible for Palestinians to establish a state there. Then another war, his ill-fated 1982 invasion of Lebanon, strengthened support for groups like Peace Now, swinging the pendulum back toward a search for negotiated peace. Prime Minister Netanyahu, who first took office in 1996, has pulled it rightward again, and his current government has supercharged that shift. His coalition relies on the support of two virulently anti-Arab ministers, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, committed to an exclusively Jewish state in all of biblical Palestine. They have also advanced the idea of driving Palestinians out of Gaza and emboldened West Bank settlers to mount violent attacks on Palestinian villages and farms. For many hundreds of thousands of Israelis, such views are anathema. Still, it remains unclear what shape a debate over Israel's post-October 7th future will take. Will Mr. Netanyahu pay the kind of political price for the war in Gaza that Israel's left-of-center leaders did after the October 1973 surprise attack? Or will the widespread and ongoing sense of post-October trauma blunt his critics' pushback? The complexity of the situation that will face Israel once the war is over was well expressed in recent comments by David Grossman, the leading Israeli novelist and a long-standing voice for an open, socially tolerant Israel, wedded to the search for coexistence with the Palestinians. Mr. Netanyahu's gravest sin, he said, had been the normalization of figures like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. He also remained worried by a Samson-like delusion that Israel's military power alone could provide true security. Yet he sensed it might now take years for Israelis and Palestinians to find the will and the trust to revive serious peace efforts. The absolute demonic evil of Hamas's attack, along with a sense of betrayal by their own government, had left Israelis despairing and shattered. Still, he did hold out a reason not to lose hope, nor to give up trying to move his country in a different direction. Israel needs peace, he declared. Backing the establishment of a Palestinian state was not about doing the Palestinians a favor. We need them, he said, exactly as they need us. You're listening to the Christian Science Monitor on Sun Sounds of Arizona for the Print Disabled. Next story. Elon Musk leaves the Trump administration. He vows to spend less money on politics. Elon Musk exits the White House, leaving investors hopeful that he will renew focus on his companies, Tesla and SpaceX. Mr. Musk gave nearly $300 million in contributions to the U.S. presidential election campaign. By Aditya Soni and Kritika Lamba. Elon Musk's break with the Trump administration means investors will hope he refocuses on his sprawling empire as Tesla battles slumping sales and after SpaceX's latest rocket launch fell short of expectations. Mr. Musk called time on his White House stint on Wednesday, giving Tesla investors some succor after shares slumped this year, in part due to the backlash to his support of U.S. President Donald Trump and right-wing parties in Europe. The billionaire also spearheaded Mr. Trump's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, charged with cutting federal spending, which generated controversy. He now returns to his empire facing several challenges, but also numerous advantages. Tesla's sales slide is testing investor patience, yet SpaceX and Starlink dominate their respective markets, often serving as the default choice for commercial launches and satellite internet deployment. Foreign governments have also increasingly looked to Starlink, with regulatory approvals smoothed by Mr. Musk's close ties to Mr. Trump. That relationship, however, has drawn scrutiny. Shortly before he announced his exit from Washington, Mr. Musk criticized the tax bill that is making its way through Congress. In addition, he had recently pledged to spend less money on politics after he plunked down nearly $300 million on Mr. Trump's presidential campaign and on other Republican candidates last year. Tesla's shares were little changed in afternoon trading on Thursday, but they have lost about 25% of their value since mid-December. The stock initially soared due to Mr. Musk's relationship with Mr. Trump and expectations for swift regulatory approval for the company's widely awaited robo-taxis. They reversed course as sales dropped and protests erupted against Mr. Musk's embrace of far-right politicians and his role in firing U.S. federal workers. Analysts say deeper operational fixes are needed to reverse its sales slump, however, as EV buyers increasingly seek out competitors, particularly in the fast-growing Chinese market. Musk's departure from Doge will improve market sentiment, but I see no real change for Tesla, said Morningstar analyst Seth Goldstein. Tesla's deliveries decline shows its current product lineup is at market saturation and facing strong competition in all three key markets of the U.S., China, and Europe. With a forward price-to-earnings ratio of roughly 165, according to LSEG data, Tesla remains far more expensive than other big tech giants like Nvidia or Microsoft, not to mention conventional auto companies. Bullish analysts such as Wedbush's Dan Ives have long contended that Tesla's future value is tied to autonomous driving, which Mr. Ives said on Thursday could be worth about $1 trillion alone for Tesla. Tesla did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Relationship with Mr. Trump. Mr. Musk's companies have benefited from his relationship with Trump. Reuters reported last week that Mr. Musk's Doge team was expanding the use of his artificial intelligence chatbot, Grok, in the U.S. federal government to analyze data. Experts told Reuters that this could give Mr. Musk access to valuable non-public federal contracting data at agencies with which he privately does business and gives him an advantage over other AI service providers. Mr. Trump's cabinet will continue to work with Doge employees across various federal agencies, the White House said on Thursday, even as at least one member of Mr. Musk's team was set to depart. Steve Davis, a close associate of Mr. Musk and key in running the agency's day-to-day operations, has stepped down from his Doge leadership role, according to a source familiar with the matter. SpaceX's launch this week failed more quickly than expected, exploding over the Indian Ocean without achieving some of its most important testing goals. The result puts another pause in Mr. Musk's speedy development goals for the rocket, which is bound to play a central role in the U.S. space program. Federal regulators had granted SpaceX a license for Starship's latest flight attempt 4 days ago, capping an investigation of a mishap that had grounded Starship for nearly 2 months. SpaceX has long had its own management team, led by Gwynne Shotwell, though after the latest launch, Mr. Musk said he planned to spend more time on the company. The Starship rocket is still many steps away from being able to land humans on the moon or Mars. He's not an official part of the government, but obviously maintains connections, said Thomas Martin, senior portfolio manager at Tesla investor Globalt Investments. So I think there's a slight diminishment of influence at the margin, but I don't think it's going to move the needle on regulatory matters anyway. Mr. Musk has been quiet for months about legislation in Congress that takes aim at electric vehicles. But late on Wednesday, Tesla Energy criticized Republican plans to end energy tax credits. Abruptly ending the energy tax credits would threaten America's energy independence and the reliability of our grid, Tesla Energy wrote on its X account. The Republican tax plan would cut tax breaks for electric vehicle purchases and leases, phase out battery production credits, and cut clean energy incentives for solar. Tesla's robo-taxi launch next month is crucial for Mr. Musk's plan to shift focus from an affordable electric vehicle to autonomous vehicles and the company's Optimus humanoid robots. Shortly after news of his Washington departure, Mr. Musk said Tesla has been testing driverless Model Y cars in Austin, Texas, with plans to deliver the first vehicles in June. Next month, first self-delivery from factory to customer, he said. Now for the Monitor's view, Africa's push for economic sovereignty. The choice of a new president of the African Development Bank underscores a renewed drive for self-reliance and unity in response to recent cuts in foreign aid. By the Monitor's editorial board. Africa's leaders are setting the clock on achieving higher economic growth for the continent. One big reason: by 2050, about 1 in 4 people on Earth will be African. A good example of this resolve was the May 29th election of a new head of the African Development Bank, a premier finance entity for driving job creation. The winner was Sidi Ould Tah of Mauritania. He most recently led the Arab Bank for Economic Development in Africa, where he quadrupled the bank's assets and secured a AAA rating. A common thread in the competitive election for a new bank president was the need to shift Africa from a dependence on foreign donors to economic self-reliance and a shared vision for investments. That goal is urgent after the slashing of American foreign aid by President Donald Trump, as well as a decline in European assistance. As Africans, we are not completely sad about these developments, Tanzania's former foreign minister told The Economist. This is what we have always been saying we want, to rely less on others. Former Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta was more blunt. Why are you crying? He asked during initial shock over the aid cuts. Instead, say, okay, what are we going to do to help ourselves? One popular answer is to tap private capital in Africa. An estimated $4 trillion is held in African banks, pension funds, and foreign reserves. The issue is, a Lagos, Nigeria-based lender told the news site Semaphore, how we get that money to flow into projects. Key targets include power supply, natural resources, and agriculture. The first challenge for Mr. Ta is to align the bank's 54 member nations toward common goals. One model of cooperation for him is the Economic Commission of West African States, which marked its 50th anniversary this year. Despite linguistic, cultural, and political differences among its more than a dozen members, it has been effective. The countries allow free movement and free trade for citizens and businesses and agree on common tariffs and policies toward non-member states. The African Development Bank now has a chance to become a true engine of continental unity, wrote Kenya-based economist Hannah Ryder in Semaphore. It can also break from an overdependence on foreign aid that has prevented a firm footing for democracy, the kind in which citizens hold elected leaders accountable for economic growth, not for how much aid is amassed. That's it. You've been listening to the Christian Science Monitor for Thursday, May 29th, 2025, on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Greg Riddell. Thanks for listening. Good night.